Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Colin McCormick.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we're digging into I, Claudius, a 1976 BBC television series adapted from the Robert Graves novels I, Claudius and Claudius the God, written by Jack Pullman and starring Derek Jacobi, Sean Phillips, Brian Blessed, and many, many other famous actors. And joining us today is another super special guest. Please welcome Liz Gloyne, reader in Latin language and literature at Royal Holloway, the University of London, and author of Tracking Classical Monsters in Popular Culture. Liz, welcome to the show. Really happy to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. It's a delight, especially to talk about I, Claudius, which, yeah, is such a cult thing in the UK in so many ways.
I understand why now, having watched the first six episodes.
Wait, we're going to get into it because we have Christy hasn't seen it. Eli, was this your first time watching this?
This is my first time all the way through. I've seen some bits of it, but I realized that they are like season two bits. So this was all new to me.
Yeah, the Latin teachers have a habit of showing little segments here and there, and people are like, oh, I know what this is about. And then you sit down for the whole thing, you're like, I did not know what this was about. Okay.
Yeah. And maybe it's timely or untimely that we have Liz on today, because as we're recording this, Halloween is just behind us, but we have a resident expert in monsters and monstrosity here.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about some of your favorite monsters you've seen in pop culture?
Yeah, absolutely. So the two that turn up most often are the Minotaur and Medusa. They are the ones who come up again and again and again. I can see you folks nodding because obviously this is like, yes, absolutely. If I were to think of the one, these would be the folks I'd go for. And they have just become so important for people for thinking through various aspects of modern life that obviously the ancient Greeks and Romans would look at and go, you what? That's the kind of the power of them, is they've been sort of reused and reimagined to deal with contemporary problems in really interesting ways. And part of that, I mean, the Minotaur in particular, part of that we can blame on Freud, blame everything on Freud, Jung, because of the way they kind of use the Minotaur as symbolic of like sort of man's inner struggle, and it normally was man's inner struggle rather than woman's inner struggle, but never mind. Man's inner struggle with the inner beast and what it meant to be human. And actually, I say the gender thing on the side, but it kind of has become, the Minotaur has become this real figure for sort of what does it mean to be a man in a way that doesn't also involve being horribly homicidal or antisocial. And that kind of conflict, I mean, very literally sometimes, turns up a lot in young adult fiction, all sorts of places, as a way of exploring, you know, what does it mean to be human, to be a good human in society without accidentally eating tributes from Athens, which, you know, is a problem we all struggle with on a daily basis.
Daily basis.
My favorite, some of my students, and I teach a mythology class right now, and are often kind of shocked when I bring up that the Minotaur is, I was about to say inexplicably, but no, very understandably, I think, popular in particularly like erotica and like gay erotica literature and things like that.
Yeah, that was kind of the bit that didn't get into the book. Because, well, you know, you go on to, you're thinking, okay, I want to have the source material. I want to, you know, I want to see what's out there. I want to read things with the Minotaur in it. And you go onto Amazon and you put the word Minotaur in, and oh boy. The amount of self-published fiction that comes up. And you can make a choice.
Yeah.
I made a particular choice, partly because I wanted people to feel they could buy this book for sixth formers who were interested in things without like traumatizing them more than strictly necessary. Sixth formers being 16 to 18 year olds. Like you, there are limits to a reasonably family friendly book. But I have actually just done a chapter that I've literally just returned the proofs for in a big collected volume on fan fiction and classical monsters, in which been able, obviously, to talk a little bit more about the sexually explicit elements. But really interestingly, you get loads and loads of, you know, hardcore, she says, reflecting on her word choice. Oh, dear.
And if there's anything you want edited out, I can help with that. Or conversely, if you're like, I love it, put it in, put it three times, double it.
I think, unfortunately, when we're talking about slash fiction, we kind of have entered the territory of there are no good words at this point. So you get that really explicit stuff with the Minotaur. With Medusa, really interestingly, you get lots and lots of really sort of romantic lesbian giving Medusa like the soft story, the soft romance story she never had. It's really interesting. I mean, obviously there's, because it's fan fiction, there's still some of the other stuff with Medusa as well, but there's kind of a really distinct difference in the way that that kind of content is materializing.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, hugely.
Yeah, all I remember is there's a show in the US called Gravity Falls. It was only one season. It was a cartoon. And there was one episode where Dipper like wants to be a man, and he goes to a cave and finds this cave of all these minotaurs who are like
the manitars.
Yeah, the manitars. And so I'm like, I didn't realize that was a thing, but
it's a whole, yeah, it's a whole lesson about like toxic masculinity, and like Dipper feels emasculated because he's not big and hairy and like lifts weight. So he goes to the manitar, which is kind of this like man utopia where they just hang around shirtless, like
shouting,
pumping iron. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, that actually in... This is the point when you realize just how geeky you've come about this. Is in the My Little Pony rebooted series, there is also an episode where a Minotaur turns up as sort of an assertiveness coach to whom Fluttershy, who is the pony who is very small and very nervous and very tiny, sort of goes to try and be assertive, and sort of essentially ends up shouting at the Minotaur because he's basically just a bully, and it's not. Oh, and then the Minotaur sort of like collapses into, oh no, I am a horrible person, and then has a revelation and goes off to be a better human, well, a better Minotaur afterwards.
You're half human.
It's kind of adorable in that kind of spaces adorableness quotient. And yeah, but again, it's still being used in these kinds of ways. It's right there.
Wow, I've never even thought about it. That's awesome.
No, and these are the ways people are meeting classical culture these days. You know, kids are watching the cartoons, kids are turning the telling on, and they're going, oh, hi, this is a perfectly normal thing to be happening. Mm-hmm. and actually, when you think about it, this is not normal. There is no reason that these creatures that came out of the myth of 2,000 years ago should still be romping around in animated television cartoons. And yet they're there, which, I mean, on the one hand is really, really weird, but also very awesome if you happen to be a complete classical reception geek like I am. Mm-hmm. Which is why I'm on this podcast.
Absolutely.
This leads me into actually now I have another question, which is, so Medusa and the Minotaur are probably, yeah, like our two biggest stars, but who is your like unsung hero, your secret favorite, slides in under the radar for most monsters, right? If you were to like tell one person, if you like monsters, this, right, this is the one that everybody sleeps on.
Yeah, I think this would be more about what I would like to see somebody make, what I would love somebody who's creative to do, rather than something that's out there right now. And the one that I always say in this situation is the Sphinx. Because I think the Sphinx is the patron monster against mansplaining.
Oh, I love it. Oh my God.
The Sphinx... Every single time she asks somebody a question, and it's the men, obviously, because this is heroes, and heroes do heroic things like listen to questions and then give the answer that they think is there, she eats them. And the only time that somebody listens, that Oedipus listens properly, actually listens to her and pays attention and doesn't try and mansplain it out, that's how she's defeated. So, as I say, I haven't actually seen any receptions like really engage with that as a thing, but I just kind of feel in my heart of hearts that is, she's kind of a monster for our times in that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right.
In that sense.
Oh, I'm obsessed. I love this.
That was part of my MA research, was like looking at the vase paintings of Oedipus and the Sphinx. And I always thought it was fascinating that they focus on Oedipus as a traveler and not as a soldier as depicted in most like hero versus monster images.
Yeah.
And thought that was such an interesting dynamic. It's like you can't brute force your way into getting rid of this monster. You just have to be reasonable and
absolutely
listen.
Absolutely. But I mean, that's so much about sort of like that, what's happened to these narratives sort of through 18th, 19th, early 20th century uses of them. That kind of the hero as this figure of power, of authority, of being able to take whatever you like because you're strong enough to. I can't think why imperial cultures would really like that kind of figure. Utterly, utterly baffling to me about why that's an attractive. I mean, who would have thought? But you've kind of got that change. But actually, when you look at the Greek representations, the Roman engagements, they're so much more complicated, and they're so much more happy to say this person had some really strong qualities, but also was awful. you know, they're much happier with that narrative complexity than obviously when you kind of get into kind of some of the flattenings of myth and the way that myth is taught. And it's like, no, the good guys are always the good guys, and we're just going to treat everything they do as good, even when it's deeply, deeply problematic. The Romans and the Greeks don't do that. Romans and the Greeks can cope with moral complexity of human beings and do so on a frequent basis.
What if even your good qualities are secretly bad qualities, like being good at riddles or wanting to know the truth or being dedicated to justice? What if these, you know, end up destroying you? But that's a conversation for another podcast. Now I think it's probably high time we switch over to the main course.
Yeah. Speaking of moral complexity.
Yeah.
Truly. Which is the BBC, or at least on our side of the pond, the PBS production of I, Claudius. And so we just open up always starting with our guests with, so Liz, do you dig I, Claudius?
If I said no, I think I might have pitchforks and talk chairs outside my department from the entirety of the UK classics community. But in a very genuine way, no, I do. This is kind of one of those pieces that I obviously, vanity. I was not around for the first screening and therefore was too young to get to the first screening, but it had kind of reached classic status, rescreening status, sort of when I was in my teens, which was when I was starting to do Latin at school. And so it was kind of around and it was kind of there, and I was old enough to watch it and to, you know, engage with it. I mean, and it sort of became part of that whole secondary school getting to grips with this kind of stuff. And it was fascinating because it was one of the few things that kind of, I think I watched from beginning to end. And this is obviously before you've got cable, before you've got watch on demand, you know, we're in the era of VHS tapes, stacked boxes. And, you know, it was one of the few things that we sort of had the full lot of and could watch from beginning to end. And that kind of made it quite a special thing, along with Ray Harryhausen movies.
Mm-hmm.
But they were kind of all part of that 1980s, 1990s, growing up with this material kind of environment. And the question of do I dig it is kind of a bit tricky, because it's like, well, this has just been about around and part of my engagement with the ancient world and its reception for so long. I can't imagine doing it any differently because of having been it being part of my landscape for so long.
Yeah, we call that nostalgia glasses, and we have that problem with Indiana Jones over here.
But it was really interesting rewatching it, because there are things you see at this point. I mean, partly obviously no longer being, you know, in your teens, also no longer being in your 20s or any other decade into which I may or may not be. And, you know, it gives you kind of a different set of different perspectives and different views. And obviously some things have definitely not aged well. But other things really do stand up, and it's really quite interesting where the difference is set.
Yeah, so I'm obviously also a little too young to have watched this as it was airing, but in my house this was a perennial. I think my mom still maybe carries the torch for Derek Jacobi, and they always sort of spoke, you know, because for them they, you know, it was a show for my parents in particular. Like, you know, when it aired on PBS, like you stopped the world for a second and everybody sat down and watched I, Claudius. But I want to hear from Christy and Eli, for whom basically they've just had to listen to me talk about this show for the last 2 years or so.
Yeah, I think I don't want to say surprised, because I knew how old it was, but some of the sets and the makeup, I was like, oh, I can see that bald cap or that wig just like sitting on top.
We'll get to Patrick Stewart in a second.
I mean, that just takes me out of it like a little bit. And it, the whole
Patrick
thing
Stewart sort of, with hair.
Yeah, obviously. But it did sort of feel more like a play than a TV show in many ways. And I think, I don't want to say it surprised me, but I was, I think, taken aback, because I'm coming to it from having watched Rome, which is like so involved and has so many more like outdoor crowd scenes, and I, Claudius is so tight and tiny and in like, you know, a series of rooms. And I think finally in like episode 5 and 6 we get outdoor like walking around a market scenes, but so much of it is just within 3 walls that it feels like a play. But I do dig it. I dig episodes 5 and 6 more than 1 through 4. And I'll get to why.
Yeah, I'll say I dig it so far. And the term that kept coming to my head is like, this is delightful. Like, just, I am enjoying this. And to me, the tight shots that Elijah's talking about, it just like made me think of soap operas and like how you always like really tight on frame. And it's like the setting doesn't really matter. It's all about the drama happening between the people. And like, they did really well with that, right? Like, there's always an interesting storyline going on between these different characters who, like I said earlier, it's like I literally had my phone out with the Judeo-Claudian family line so I could figure out who was who and what the relationship was to each other. And, you know, did Livia actually kill this one too or not? Like, so I think they were talking, like, I just read up a little bit. They talked about how, you know, this is kind of the precursor to a lot of shows we see later with large complex casts that like change kind of quickly over time, like Game of Thrones and things like that. And I like that Rome has all of those amazing sets and Easter eggs, and you can feel immersed in that space. But this one I liked because it's like I was really invested in knowing who these individuals were and what their relationships were to each other. So that was kind of the part I really enjoyed. I had some issues with some things, but like overall, my other thought this whole time, Colin, was like, you were so upset with Derek Jacobi coming back as Claudius in Rotten Romans, the movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting here, especially watching Augustus, I'm like, okay, this is hammy. This is hammy sometimes. And it makes perfect sense that he would come back to another movie show to ham it up one last time as Claudius. So I don't know what you're complaining about.
It's Brian Blessed. You don't have Brian Blessed without several sides of ham being delivered at the same time. I mean, this is... And yet, even though it is that, he still manages to do those moments of upset and get across quite a complicated character whilst also being full-on Brian Blessed, which is pretty impressive, really.
Mm-hmm.
So just a little context for listeners. So we're talking today particularly about the first half of the show. So episodes 1-6 thereabouts, which more or less covers the reigns of Augustus and Tiberius and getting into Caligula. But I don't know if we wanted to go through sort of sequentially, if we wanted to maybe talk sort of characters. Liz, you just brought up, you know, Augustus, who's probably one of the biggest characters. I mean, and that's, I think, courtesy of Brian Blessed. What do you all think? Do you want to work through it or jump around?
I feel like characters make sense, but Lash has a summary.
I have a little summary. It's like very small, but just it's like kind of an overview of, I guess, what you would call the plot. But yeah, I, Claudius begins with the older Emperor Claudius writing the story of his life. So we have this framing device. And he actually begins before his birth with some of the machinations of his grandmother, Livia, who is the wife of the Emperor Augustus. And the first four episodes, we kind of go down all of these mysterious deaths of all of Augustus's heirs, Marcellus, Gaius, Lucius, Postumus, Germanicus. And really, we're sort of left with Tiberius, which is Livia's son. He becomes emperor at Augustus's own mysterious death after eating some questionable figs. And in episode 5 and 6, we sort of get Livia confessing a lot of these murders and manipulations to Claudius, who has been overlooked all of this time because of his stutter, because of his limp, and his general Claudiusness. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of where we've left off at episode 6. Mm-hmm. And that's just sort of a general structure that we can work within. Mm-hmm. Because, yeah, I think the characters are the big part of this.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the plot is very slow and plodding in the first 3 to 4 episodes. And I think that's why I liked 5 and 6 a lot better. We're really starting to get to like deep into the stuff, especially with Caligula. So I think characters would be a great way to start.
So do we start with Augustus or Livia?
I feel like we can't. It all comes back to him, right?
Maybe. Yeah,
I know it does.
Okay. I mean, Brian Blessed's performance, to me, is one of the standouts, you know, not just the like, has anyone in Rome not slept with my daughter? Like, you know, but.
Although that is a classic moment, in fact.
Truly. Brian Blessed, who, you know, people of my generation may be more familiar with for his work as Boss Nass in The Phantom Menace.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, he's the big Gungan who's, you know, gives them the whatever it's called, the Onga Bunga or whatever. Anyways.
I'm stunned right now.
In the UK, it's Prince Vulton and Flash Gordon that is Brian Bless's standouts. Yes.
because we are just coming off of talking about HBO's Rome, where in that show, Augustus is a much more calculating, political-minded, almost like machine-like sort of entity. And then this kind of Augustus is a very I was watching an interview with Brian Blessing where he described it. It's very kind of mafia-esque. He's loud. He's boisterous. He's very personable. But I wanted to see what people think of this sort of portrayal of Augustus, and particularly like old, where, you know, we get old Augustus, right? He's kind of in his twilight years.
Yeah, he gives us sort of full, he gives us kind of full bonhomie, doesn't he? I mean, he's very much kind of that, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of. There's a conversation he has just before he dies with Claudius, which is very much on the, you know, if you'll look out for me, I'll look out for you, as he's suddenly clearly realizing that Claudius has been following good advice. He's been given to exaggerate how useless he is so that nobody will try and kill him. It's a survival strategy in the first century, but he's very much in that kind of mode. And then I think what came out for me on the reviewing this time round was how well Augustus Blessed brings out Augustus's ability to, on the one hand, say, here is the moral line that we're holding to. And then on the other hand goes, but it doesn't matter if we slip the moral line, so long as nobody notices. That kind of playing off of here is the standard, but also here is the double standard, providing that we all do this as an agreement amongst gentlemen kind of thing, was, I thought, really effective in that characterization about where that line was and where the choices were.
I liked that you could really see almost like a flip in the way he was portraying Augustus, where he was this big, loud, boisterous, charismatic person, but he would almost slip out of it sometimes and like say, hold that line, or like say something that's like, I am the emperor.
He was my enemy too, you know, looks.
Yes. And it's like, you could like see him going in and out of this mask almost. And I liked that version of the persona of Augustus versus maybe like the real life person who obviously like lived this life. And we know, I feel like, as historians and classicists, all of the background, like we have all of this baggage and background. We know what happened to Augustus as a younger person. And I feel like I read that so much into old Augustus. Mm-hmm. But I guess I don't know how someone new to the entire story would see that. How are you reading Augustus if you don't have all of this baggage that we're coming to?
I'm reminded, this is not exactly an answer to your question, but when they were filming HBO's Rome, there was kind of this disagreement over the edits for the version that showed in the States versus the version that showed in the UK. And there was a lot of stuff that was cut from the first episode. That was a lot of the like kind of context and politicking and then sort of exposition. And the argument put forward by the BBC, I believe, was that we could shave all that stuff for the UK audience and not the American audience, because the British audience would be already versed in this kind of history and they wouldn't need a reminder of who Cato was or something like that, which is, I'm not sure who it's sort of more insulting of or assumption of the assumptions are. But yeah, no, there is a bit of maybe assuming on behalf of the show of like, we don't need. Although we get a little bit of it, sort of, you know, we get the context and maybe we get as much as we need to know, which is like, you know, Augustus and Agrippa are old war buddies. They're like men of a sort of bygone generation that, you know, now the youth, you know, I like the bits with Marcellus who's kind of critiquing and mocking Agrippa at their dinner that like, you know, oh, yeah, you won your battles, but be quiet, old man. That kind of stuff. So I don't know. Christy, what do you think?
So something I thought was interesting about Augustus as Livia, and what really made me think of it, was Claudius explaining his reason for writing this whole history. And it's like, it's not going to be read for, what was it, 1900 years?
Yeah, very conveniently. Right?
Must find the right box to hide
that
it in.
Straight out of the Graves book, right?
Yeah.
That's the framing conceit, that it's like, this is Claudius's actual diary that was unearthed, right, in the year 1930 or whenever.
Well, my thought was like, it was really interesting because it was this idea of writing something for posterity. Because, you know, I think of writing today, and even there was a few characters in the show, like I think Horace, who's like orating some of his poetry, and he's like, oh, you like this, you can have my book or whatever later. And it's like, yeah, a lot of the times we write for the modern audience. I don't know how many people necessarily write something to be remembered and like referred to for all of time. I thought it was really interesting.
Thucydides.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of Augustus, right? Like so much of why he's in this position and kind of doesn't retire, but wants to uphold this important family image is like he wants his family to be known in posterity versus Livia is like, I want the power for us now. And like, I'll be patient. I will wait forever, but I will have my piece of cake at the end of the day. And she doesn't seem as concerned with the like kind of, but like not to the same extent Augustus is, and why he can be like, you know, wink, wink. Yeah, you can do this on the side, but the image must be upheld for. So like everyone looks at me and looks at our family and is like, we're good. And I thought that was kind of an interesting way to portray him of like, you know, enjoy life the way you need to, but we have to uphold this veneer.
Coming back to what Eli was saying about what people would make of this coming to this, I think what's quite interesting to me is that for Augustus's characterization, the hinge point, the thing where it really shifts, is when the news of the loss of the eagles comes from the Teutoburg Forest. So Varus has taken 3 lieges into the middle of the Teutoburg Forest with the German tribes. What could possibly go wrong? Oh, wait, that would be mass slaughter. And he loses 3 of the eagles, the symbols of these tribes. And we've got records, you know, historical records about how distraught Augustus is about this fact. This is a massive military loss. And the series makes that loss this huge moment of, you know, much worse than losing any of his heirs, much less than, you know, that along with the discovery of his daughter's Julia's mass infidelity. Those are kind of the two moments where Augustus really loses it in terms of sort of not being able to keep up a public facade, not being able to cope. Those are like the big crack points in him. And I think even if you don't know all of the pre-stuff that's gone forward, there are still these kinds of things about military success and risk and about family and loyalty and those kinds of ideas that are very revealing of Augustus in a way that makes sense if you know the backstory, but also if you don't.
Yeah. And on the family note, I mean, the thing that I like about this Augustus is the what the show really dwells on is his fixation on like morality in Rome, right? He's like, I want to have a sort of moral Rome and I want my family to be the model for it, right? And so like, I want people to be in marriages and I want there to be Roman citizens marrying other Roman citizens and having Roman babies. And there's too much moral depravity. One of my favorite little small scenes is when he has Horace over and he sleeps through all of Horace's poems and then gets up and is like, oh, like Horace, this is why I like you so much because you are, you know, you write good things. I'm not that Ovid guy who just writes smut.
I did enjoy that.
You know, that made me laugh.
Which is for me, I'm like, this is why I don't like Horace and I love Ovid. But
yeah, right.
but like that leads into his whole kind of, I mean, vice or his failure, his flaw in this show, which is his such strong desire to have this kind of his family be the model family for Rome. And then he, you know, his sort of blind eye that he turns to the sort of shortcomings or the failures inside his own house, and that he really just does not want to acknowledge all this stuff going on around him, that his daughter would be having extramarital affairs or that his wife would be poisoning his heirs, you know. And that I think it's the first end of the first episode where he, you know, he has Livia there with Gaius and Lucius. He's like, this is the model Roman family. And like what he wants so bad and also sort of blinds him to the problems that are, you know, the cracks in the foundation, so to speak. And then also, again, that leads into the, you know, why it's so outrageous to him, why when Julia's behavior comes to light and why he explodes in the way he does.
Also the fact that like everyone knows but Augustus, and like everyone knows that Augustus doesn't know. So he's the last to find out. Like,
I'm thinking about his death now, and he finally seems to be aware, and he has this whole like, I only want to eat the food that I pick myself, and seems to have at the end this terrible inkling that, oh my God, this was happening all along. And that's a really like, his death was like a really terrifying sequence of that maybe like realization actually finally dawning that Livia is actually doing all of these things. Yeah, the figs were great.
Don't touch the figs.
Yes. because you've got this moment, haven't you, where he is spoken to by, who is it? Who is the person who speaks to him?
Posthumus?
Is it Posthumus? Or Posthumus, like, open your eyes, grandfather. You know, like, can you not see what's going on?
No, somebody else. It's Jim. Posthumus tells Claudius. Mm-hmm. Claudius tells Germanicus. Mm-hmm. Germanicus mm-hmm. tells Augustus. Mm-hmm. Augustus mm-hmm. goes to Posthumus in exile, because obviously Posthumus is in exile on a Tylee island at this point, inevitably. It sort of turns up incognito with a cowl over his head and a nobody will recognize me kind of way. It's glorious, glorious television. Yes. So, but you get, as you say, you get this train of information suddenly trickling through. And even before there's that moment where that's been passed on, you already have the relationship between Livia and Augustus worsening. You know, she's going, oh, I can't do anything with you, she says. His mind's going. And, mm-hmm. and you know, you're kind of sitting there going, actually, some of the ways Augustus is behaving, for those of us who know anything about dementia, that's not actually as out the park as it might seem as an mm-hmm. accusation. But there's always that question about how much does he actually know? Does he know that Livia has been doing this? Does he believe the stuff he's being told? How far is this going? And then, yeah, it all ends in don't touch the figs, which is just...
Oof, that scene feels like it goes, I mean, it simultaneously happens very quickly, but also feels like an eternity as you just watch his face and just basically see the life go out of his eyes. Mm-hmm. I don't know I got to go back and watch it, right? But if you can like pinpoint the moment, like when he's, you know, when we lose him or if you can or if you can't, but there's just like at some point you just know like, oh, he's dead now.
Mm-hmm. Which is such a wonderful piece of acting by Blessed as well. I mean, that's mm-hmm. that's the thing. It's like that being able to hold it, because it is extended and you have Livia essentially confessing over the top. Mm-hmm. I mean,
like with good actors, when they like they're doing so much without doing anything, in the sense where it's like he's not moving, he's not doing anything, but he's acting without acting. It's just like kind of mm-hmm. I don't know, it's this next level kind of move. But you know, that's,
and I feel like his whole portrayal of Augustus has that, where it's like even when he's not saying anything, it's or not doing anything, just standing in the room, it feels like he's still a gut. Mm-hmm. And I think that works so, so well.
Yeah. I was also thinking about that, you know, that transfer of information that was like laid out for us, which is like, yep, it was very kind of a telephone game. But it, like also it really started too with the two historians that Claudius just comes upon, right? And they're like highly aware of like supposedly what Livia is doing. And maybe this will transition us into Livia, that's kind of what I find problematic at the same time, right? Like we're assuming these historians outside of the family are very aware of what's going on and who's responsible for those events. And I mean, that's why we have this question of Livia and, you know, just how much she contributed to the deaths of certain individuals in the family is from historians telling mm-hmm. us that, not from, you know, Claudius and the family is like, evil woman, I shall write it all down.
Right.
Yeah, it's probably worth saying, isn't it, for people who might not be as familiar with the history, that the trope of saying that women who exerted power poisoned people mm-hmm. is a first century, second century staple. And, you know, it's a way of indicating that women who obviously can't hold political office in the Roman Empire are attempting to exert power through means they shouldn't do. Agrippina has similar accounts of various murders laid against her. Basically, there seems to be a trope of first century imperial ladies do poison, even if there seems to be absolutely no evidence, either contemporary or shortly afterwards, of this. It's just one of those things you accuse bad imperial women of, and badness in this mm-hmm. context means wanted to be involved in politics. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's right. Basically what it is. What then Graves has done, and then has happened in the screenplay, is Graves has looked at this and gone, excellent, poisoning women! Mm-hmm. I can make a drama out of that!
Yeah.
So it's worth sort of drawing that line in between the historical reality of Livia and this version, Graves's version, this television mm-hmm. adaptations of Livia, because the two things have very few contact points, certainly as far as murderous intent goes, I think.
Really, like, Graves is kind of working on Suetonius and Tacitus, and I think Tacitus is the one who kind of plants that seed, and then Graves runs with it, and then that
makes that poison even more people.
Yeah.
Graves runs with it, and then that becomes the template for many a character sort of going forward, like kind of a forerunner for like a Cersei Lannister or something like that. It becomes a sort of trope in and of itself.
I thought there was a really interesting setup for that too, because that is the other accusation of where we see poisoning happening is doctors, right? So Marcellus is the very first one, and Livia goes to Marcellus and is trying to convince him to like let her handle. It was like, I think you're being too obvious. So I was like, I will handle all your food. And you, it's like, I would not admit to that. But anyway, but she like says, it's like, oh, Augustus had a summer chill. And like, it wasn't the doctor's potions that like helped him recover. It was my nursing. And like, I thought that was really interesting. Again, going into medicine of the time of like, yeah, the doctors are often accused of poisoning their patients so they can usually sleep with a wife or something like that. Women have access to people in vulnerable periods of time because they are expected to nurse those individuals.
Yeah, I was just going to say that idea of the mater familias being the person who do the nursing, the medical stuff, the domestic role. I mean, that's totally appropriate for Livia to be doing, especially if we're in Augustus's idealized family. And then it turns out that she also gets the doctor, or at least, well, she doesn't also get the doctor because she says at the end that she didn't actually kill Germanicus. But there's kind of the moment where there's like, did she nobble the doctor? Mm-hmm. But given how much she's happy to confess to elsewhere, I don't think we have to assume she's fibbing about that one, really.
Maybe this is just me and when I'm reading it, but as I'm sort of particularly in this episodes 5-6, I really kind of come around, I personally come around a big way on Livia, and I'm like, you know what? I'm in her corner a little bit. I think she might have been right. Because she kind of lays out for Claudius at one point. She's like, look, like I did everything I did because we can't go back to the Republic. Like, I remember what it was like, and it sucked, and it was bad, and it was civil war and corruption for as long as anyone can remember. So I had to get rid of the Republicans like Drusus and Germanicus, right? Where she has her final kind of confessions to Claudius of not remorse, but kind of like, I am aware of everything I'm doing and how bad it is, which is why it's so important to me that you make me a goddess so I don't suffer for all of the crimes that I've committed. And like, I stand by the crimes, right? It's this almost like sin eater thing where she's like, I have to be this villain because it's the right thing to do for Rome. And, you know, we can debate whether or not that's sort of true, but she acts sort of with a very, you know, she's on this like next level, higher brain level that I'm like, yeah, you know what? Like, I stand for Livia.
I have to, at this point, confess my undying love for Sean Phillips in this role. I think she is an amazing actress. I think she does a fantastic job of keeping the poker face in the moments where it's like, how is she going to cope? And when I was in my early 20s, I would very much have said Livia is life goals. Having rewatched it, I'm now kind of going, maybe actually killing off most of my family would not be life goals in the way it might have been in my early 20s. That is a reflection worth thinking about. But again, I should also confess that in a very geeky part of my life, I did at one stage play Livia in a read through that we did of the entire of the scripts, and that was fun. So yeah, having been sitting inside this Livia's mind is quite something. But yeah, I think there are two things about the way that the arc goes, right? That you can see she's always strictly rational, strictly, and that I think for me is really interesting opposite Augustus's big the bonhomie. I come back to bonhomie, sort of his force of nature nurse. You've got Livia doing her letters while they're sort of at the games. You know, you go dance. This is what else am I going to do? Who else is going to work? who's got the imperial seal? Nobody else will do the paperwork. You know, I mean, you've got her as being this very kind of organized person with her spy networks and in charge of everything, and her sense of order appeals to me. What can I say? But she is on top of it. And that, of course, compares to sort of occasionally she said things like, I am but a weak woman. And you're like, We see the stereotype. But when you come around to that last bit about you must make me a goddess because otherwise I'm going to suffer, on the one hand, that makes absolute sense in the arc. There is part of me that kind of goes, yeah, but that's a really Christian way of understanding sin. That's a really Christian way of articulating what's going on here. Mm. That wouldn't have been the way that the historical Livia would have worried about what was going to happen to her, because everyone goes to Hades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everyone's down there. It's fine. So there's something now that kind of, I don't think in previous watchings, kind of irritated me, or not even irritated me, sort of rubbed me slightly the wrong way about the way that that's framed as kind of this ethical sin-based mm-hmm. redemption mm-hmm. thing. You will also have noticed, of course, the very heavy dropping of references to Jesus Christ.
I was going to say,
it's about him, because you can't possibly have a 1960s or 70s adaptation set in the first century Rome that doesn't mention Jesus. Hey!
Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
nobody cared. Nobody cares. It's Judea. It's irritating. Judea is just a pain in
this. We've talked about this on the show before, but in like many, many depictions of antiquity, there's basically four places that exist. And it's in order: Rome, Britain, Judea, Egypt. And then that's absolutely basically like, you would think those are the only places that, you know, anything ever happened.
We do get Germany. We do get the Rhine. We get the Rhine in this, admittedly not terribly much, but it's there. But yeah, as I say,
it's mentioned.
It's mentioned. It features. Bad things happen there.
You mentioned the table read, which is the other thing that part of the, you know, why I kind of am so inclined to like stand for Livia is because she's also just like the funnest character to be around. Mm-hmm. She's whip smart and she's got all of these great lines. I just love her, like when Augustus has got kind of young Claudius, she's like, I was using him as a model. She's like, a model for what? Idiocy? or like when she's talking to Tiberius and he's like, the day that something occurs to you that hasn't already occurred to me, you will light my funeral pyre.
Yeah.
So there's nothing that has occurred to you that hasn't already occurred to me.
Yeah. My all-time favorite is when she goes to the gladiators and her opening line is, you're all scum and you know it. And then basically tells the gladiators that they have to go and die well. I mean, it's in some ways, like what she's saying is like, on the surface of it, horrendous, right? Because she's like telling a bunch of, you know, enslaved people to go die for their entertainment. But there is something kind of irresistibly and undeniably appealing and endearing not endearing, but like, it's just, you know, it's good watching.
My favorite line she did was Tiberius yells at her, she's like, why can't you be a normal woman? It's like, I'll be a normal woman when there's normal men around me.
And again, and like, she's not wrong, right?
Yeah, you know, exactly.
You do kind of feel part of her frustration and her weariness is that she just feels like I am surrounded by idiot men that I have to kind of tiptoe around.
Mm-hmm. Because otherwise the empire is going to fall. Absolutely. Yeah. I mm-hmm. have got to make sure that this doesn't collapse. I am invested in this project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, like if we think of her, I don't know. I mean, she's cast, I guess, as the villain. I'm going to put a question mark on that, but she's the best kind of villain because she mm-hmm. has a motive that she really, really believes in. She has an actual goal, and abstractly, I guess I kind of get it. Like if from a woman's perspective on civil war and mm-hmm. like what happens to just normal people in Rome during civil war, yeah, I feel like she would be like, let's never do that again. That was mm-hmm. awful. And it hurt families and women just as much as it hurt men running around being soldiers. Mm-hmm. And maybe like the men in her life don't have that perspective. So in the big scheme of things, I do get it. And I love her villainousness with this motive. It feels real.
She's very non-apologetic. Mm-hmm. She's very sort of, I am doing what needs to be done. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell you more than you need to know. I'm not going to sugarcoat this for you. There are a number of scenes where she confronts somebody who she is essentially winding up to do what she wants them to do. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's very manipulative. And sometimes it's very, here are my cards.
Yeah.
I'd like to die now or later. but she is very focused on what she's aiming for, what her goals are, where she's mm-hmm. going. She's you don't ever get any sense of doubt about, you know, she has made her decision and she's following through.
So also part of it is like this idea of the empire versus the republic, where we're in this sort mm-hmm. of period where there's this open question of, you know, when Augustus dies or retires, right? Are we going to go back to the republic? Are we never going to go back to the republic? And the show is somewhat nostalgic for the Republic, where the characters like Drusus and Germanicus, who are unequivocally good characters, sort of want to return. Claudius seems to express Republican sentiments. And I'm just wondering, like, we've talked about on the show a little bit how the Republic, right, like, for all of the problems that the Empire poses and emperors and everything that comes with, you know, absolute rule in a monarchy, like, sort of, it doesn't retroactively make the Republic a better thing, right? Because, like, the Republic was, the reason Augustus happened was because the Republic was definitely not functioning sort of as intended, or was not functioning for everybody. So I'm sort of over here being like, Livia's kind of right, right? Like, the Republic, at least in that later stage, as she knew it in her lifetime, was bad news for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And it's all these people born after, all these men born after the Republic with these kind of lofty notions. And it feels like the show is sort of more on in that camp of, like, that the Republic is sort of a good thing.
But it comes back, doesn't it, to sort of Agrippa at the start of the Agrippa-Marcellus conflict, right, at the start of the film. It's going, like, I was there, I have the experience, I know what it was like, and you young uppity things haven't got a clue. And actually, Livia is kind of playing that battle out too, except she's playing it out against the younger Republican idealists who are saying, well, of course we want a Republic, and Livia is going, and no. Except I'm not going to shout at you about that over a dinner party. I will just send you my slightly dodgy doctor or other options. You know, I mean, the kind of question about experience versus idealism, I suppose, is actually really playing all the way through. And even though Livia then ends up sort of being part of Tiberius's reign in a kind of experience kind of way, again, there's still a sense in which she's saying, I know far more than you do, even though I'm getting to a frailer end of old age. And then, of course, what will happen in the next half of the series, and spoilers, Caligula happens. And Caligula, of course, has no experience, no brains. No, I mean, you know, he has no brains. But, you know, in terms of sort of thinking through this kind of politically stuff, he has got nothing. And then actually you see the difference between Augustus, who's got Livia, who at least is thinking through stuff. You've got Tiberius, who has got the military experience, which means he makes certain decisions, but Livia, again, is still around and shown as being complementary, if not as strong an influence. And then you get into somebody who has got absolutely, who we've seen as a child in the series, who turns up as a child in the series.
A very creepy child.
Extremely creepy child. But yeah, so, and we suddenly see that child being put into a position of power or authority. And it's like, okay. So the whole, the whole of the series, in a way, is almost this meditation on knowledge and experience and making the judgments that come from having that lived experience through the Civil War or other kinds of contexts.
Part of it is also the, like, degradation of the whole imperial family, where it's not just that, like, people kind of get worse as, like, each emperor is kind of successively worse, but also just, like, the whole game kind of is played sloppier. Like, we get these kind of later iterations of Livia, but they're all, like, B and C tier versions of Livia. Like, the plots become leaner and sloppier and more transparent. Everybody's, like, vices or their schemes, everything just kind of, like, everybody gets worse at it in some way.
Yeah. So there was something interesting. I think there's been an entire documentary about the production of I, Claudius that I'm really interested in watching now, because it apparently only cost
60,000 pounds.
60,000 pounds to produce and things like that.
That's
and initially, the actor playing Livia, she wanted to create a complex character that you could see her motivations for why she's doing what she's doing. And she commented on, like, it wasn't working. And the direction given to her is, like, just, you know, play up full evil. You're great at that. Just be the villainess. And, like, yeah, it produced something really interesting, an excellent character. But as I, you know, looked at her and then looked at some of the other characters, like Julia, it fully played up, like, how promiscuous she was. Like, so promiscuous, there's an entire room full of men that have all slept with her.
Not to mention the vague orgy scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The random people lying around with partial nudity to indicate sexual wasword. We're in the 1970s, folks.
Yeah. Well, and is it Livilla who, you know, cries rape to get Posthumus taken out? And, like, you even hear this discussion between, I think it's Claudius and Germanicus being like, oh, we hear that trope all the time of like women crying rape or something. It's like, yeah, but I leave posthumous this time. And then the final one with her, like that I think of is Piso's wife, who she's like, oh, let's die together. But instead she just manipulates it to stab him. And I just got to this point of like, man, they really do not like women in this show. Like they really tend to try to show women at the worst and only the men get to really be these this ideal. Like Antonia hates her son Claudius. And I think that's what started to irk me, is that like the show was drawing so much from women in proximity to power need to be critiqued. And not that the men aren't too, but like it was really played up in the show.
This is an interesting generational thing, because I think for me, those kinds of things are very much about women finding space in which to respond to power, as opposed to meekly follow where they're supposed to go and what they're supposed to do. It's about actually when you are not part of the official power structures and when you don't have places to go, how do you do it? And obviously we've had plenty of shows and plenty of things since then that have carried on asking that question and engaging that question and have managed to do so in ways which now feel less as if they're doing the misogyny tropes.
Mm-hmm.
Time actually to see these women not just going, yes, dear, and doing stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's important to remember that in that period, that kind of action is different, is unusual, and is standing out a bit, I think.
Yeah, like I still love the characters, and I think it was that same question of like, oh, is this life goals? Like, should this be life goals? But at the time, it's like, this is inspiring. These are not just passive background characters. So yeah, it's like I love it, but at the same time, it's like I wish she would have felt more supportive in the idea that she could create a more layered character of Livia. Like, that's a really interesting headspace to think that she was in when she created that character.
So I don't want to go too long because I have to end up editing this episode, but we've talked for an hour and we've talked about two characters, which I think is a testament to the show. But I guess that leaves us right to my mind, the kind of the big people left on the docket are Tiberius and Claudius himself, right?
Yeah.
And side note, Herod, because I love Herod. But
I love Herod just kind of lounging and just being like, I'm a complete thirst trap and I'm just hanging out.
He
and
is just being like,
you're Roman. And also, I am so not Roman. So all of your Roman problems, your Roman problems are not my problems. You do your thing and I'm just here. Yeah.
You Romans are a contentious people.
And tiny child Herod. Tiny child Herod. Okay. He comes up and is, hello, I am super polite and adorable. Ask me home and give me biscuits.
And then, and then he's like, my grandfather murdered my father when I was born. They're like, oh, was so good. I do love Herod. Well, I mean, again, with the very not so subtle hintings at what's going on in Judea in the first century.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted to talk a little bit Tiberius, because I like this depiction of Tiberius a lot. I like how he's so curmudgeonly and grumpy and sits there wringing his hands about, why don't people like me? And just be like, because you suck, man. Like,
you have no people skills. You threaten to throw astrologers down cliffs. This is not the way.
And it's the episode where they find out that one of the heirs is dead, and then him and Thrasyllus just break out into laughter.
Yep.
Hysterical, nervous laughter. And you're like, yep. And the poor legate who's bought the news is standing there going, everyone in Rome is distraught. This is not the appropriate emotional response.
As this should be. Yes.
Yeah, I do like that he's such a curmudgeon, that he's just so grumpy. And I feel like, I guess this is just coming back to like how much Robert Graves has like influenced the way that we think about history, at least kind of pop history wise. But I feel like this has always been like my vision of Tiberius. Like, he's grumpy. He's like, has none of the charisma that Augustus had. He has no ability to like have a mask or to switch anything on. He's a blank slate. It's all laid out there and it's crappy.
And I think the scene that really sells it is when he's being carried through the forum in his litter, and his mother's litter comes up, and he's like, and he's like an old man, and his mother is an even older woman, basically browbeating him in public. Yeah. And it's just, you know, he reminds me of like Principal Skinner in The Simpsons, where he's like, yes, mother. And like, just this, like this guy who just cannot get out from under his mother. And it's turned him into this like goblin, basically.
I think what I find difficult about this representation of Tiberius is I'm totally there on the frustrated man who just wants to be able to marry the woman he wants to marry, who doesn't want to be pulled in, which is, of course, what happens at the start of the episode, that we see his relationship with his ex-wife, Vipsania. He's forced to marry Julia because Julia wants to marry him, and that all goes horribly wrong. And you feel for him. You really feel for this kind of being stuck in this dynastic mess he doesn't want to. And you can kind of see where that bitterness and that grumpiness comes from. And I'm totally there with that arc. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the start of episode 6, mm-hmm. at which point Claudius is at a dinner party with a number of other people where the hostess reveals horrible things, horribly sort of sexually violating things that she's been forced to do by the emperor, and then kills herself because it's been so shocking and so awful. And my problem is that that characterization of Tiberius kind of comes out of nowhere in episode 6. And it's kind of like, I don't buy this.
I don't
by the way that transition works. In the books, it kind of works. But because the first 5 episodes have spent so long on the mother-son relationship and on his frustrations with Augustus and having to do what Augustus says and then going and sulking on Capri and all the rest of it, that when you get to that sudden revelation at the start of 6, it's like that's come out of nowhere. That really just jumped out to me this term as being a really awkward segue.
Mm-hmm. And I think he says something to the effect, like he has a conversation with his brother Drusus where he's like, there's a darkness inside of me or something, like mm-hmm. I've got all these like these dark thoughts, and kind of this implication that Drusus was kind of like one of the people that was keeping him like kind of in the light, so to speak. And then without certain like handlers or safeguards or something like that, once the influence of his mother diminishes or once his brother is out of his life, then he goes full tilt into his darker side.
Full edgelord.
Yeah. I mean, I have to say, sort of rewatching that stuff and again, the scene with Vipsania, his ex-wife, I mean, those kinds of comments about dark thoughts in those first episode actually kind of feel almost like it's suicidal ideation. It feels mental health stuff.
Yeah.
That kind of dark side stuff is kind of sitting in that place of having those, that depressive element to him. And he talks about that as being, you know, something that Drusus lets him out of, the depressive side of things, which of course then does hinge over into, can then be read forward. But at that moment, and it's sort of said in episode 1 and then disappears completely, and suddenly you're back in episode 6.
There is kind of a like you know, part A and then part C and part B is question mark, right? Where like
and you've kind of thought all that dark side is coming out in the grumpiness and the depression and the I'm really just fed up with this whole thing and I just want to go and sit on my rock and not care. And it's for me, the characterization falls down as far as that's concerned in the transitions and the way it's screened.
I also feel like it's the way that they do that reveal. It's like Tiberius isn't even in the room, right? It's like it's this after the fact story that's being told by his victim, but like we're not focused on him. So I think his absence and like him not actually, not that I want to like see him do anything terrible, but it's like he's not even in the room. It's not like she's accusing him to his face. That also feels like he's separated from it. I'm like, who are we talking about? Tiberius? That grumpy old guy? Like that, I think also I have trouble with.
Like Caligula, I could see doing some shit like that. But
yeah. 100%. He's creepy from the beginning. And they, you know, set
creepy
up
from the age of 8.
You know, contributing to Germanicus' death, which is one of my favorite parts of the book. And I wish there had been more of that. But he's creepy from the beginning. But Tiberius, I agree that I don't like the way that that shows.
I feel like the other place they try to set it up a little bit is the accusation that Julia like throws at him. It's like, oh, I've got a nice slave boy to give you if that's your preference. And then he slaps her, which is like, you know, kind of the first time you see him very strongly reacting in some way, right? And that's what gives him his initial exile. I think they kept trying to kind of hint at it, but like there's so much going on, it gets a little lost.
And there's kind of a difference in between Tiberius has a sexual preference and Tiberius is an awful sexually depraved human being who is forcing senators' wives to give in to his lusts. I'm totally with him. And I mean, Julia makes a comment right in the first episode that Tiberius only saw Vipsania's back. Again, the same kind of suggestion about sexual preferences. But again, it doesn't, that in and of itself doesn't take us all the way to debauching senators' wives. There's Yeah.
Kind of, well, one thing I do like about the thing that they kind of, I think, get, at least about the sort of depiction of Tiberius's reign, is the like paranoia that fuels the whole thing, and that feeds into his like, he's like, why doesn't anybody love me? And then that leads into this just nonstop treason trials, which his mother ribs him over. It's like, oh, no treason trials today. Like,
could it be Sejanus? Could it be evil Patrick Stewart?
It's the toupee made him do it. Which
maybe that's a good transition to Claudius too, because I mean, that's kind of the frame he's in too, right? Like, which is really interesting to think about, is like, this family has accrued so much power, but then that leaves these emperors feeling so vulnerable that like they can't eat, they can't sleep, and yeah.
He knows people are trying to poison him. People are listening in the walls.
Yeah, it's worth saying that, you know, we see him from a child. We see him, and there are kind of all of these signs, because obviously there are signs that he's going to be emperor. He captures a really poorly wounded wolf cub that an eagle drops, which is, I mean,
sibling.
Adorable puppy.
And his adorable mom, can I keep it?
Yes, exactly.
I loved that. I was like, that is exactly what a child would do.
Exactly. Yeah. You've got prophecies that Livia has taken out of the Sibylline books because they say he's going to be emperor. You've got all of these kinds of dripped signs that he is kind of like, yes, no. And then there's kind of the, do we believe in omens? Do we not believe in omens? All the rest of it. But in these episodes, he is very much sitting there going, am I going to die or not? Where am I on the uselessness scale? And people keep on telling him, be more useless, exaggerate the limp, exaggerate the stutter, make it clear that you're not any good, you know, that is how you're going to stay safe. And yet we see him sort of doing a history of the Etruscans and wanting to do a history of his father and, you know, actually having the intellectual acumen, as we know the historical Claudius did. So yeah, there's kind of this real tension in between what people think of Claudius and what Claudius can actually do. And that's really interesting for these six episodes, I think, in sort of that characterization.
And I do really like the kind of progression of characters realizing, like, Augustus is like, everybody says you're an idiot, but I don't think you're actually an idiot. You know, maybe looks are deceiving. And then
who would have thought?
Yeah. And the best bit with Livia when she's like, lost the stutter, I see. But yeah, so this, you know, just this like the interesting relationship that Claudius has with his grandmother, where he kind of, she's his demon and nightmare that he has, you know, like visions of, you know, she's haunting him well into his later life. But then that he, in some ways, they are sort of the most closely allied, or they're the two that kind of see each other most clearly and under each other in this real like tense relationship.
And there's loyalty there too, right? Because she says to him, she says, well, Caligula has promised me that I will be a goddess, but I'm just going to tell you in case. And then on her deathbed, in a horrific scene, because if we didn't already know Caligula was going to be horrific, here's the hint. He is awful to her and says, no, you can die, and I will be a god, and I will look down on you, and I will enjoy you suffering. Ha, 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 ha. And then disappears. Yeah. And then Claudius comes in and promises her, no, I will see that you're a god, grandmother. And it is, I mean, historical fact that it was Claudius who made sure that Livia was deified. So you kind of have, again, there's that weird pull of family relationship. And again, this runs through the whole series. Family loyalty. Who are you loyal to? What are you loyal to? When does that loyalty get overcome by other things? Which, of course, we saw Livia tackling with as well.
Yeah. And like that aspect of the story, it is what kind of intrigues me too about the depiction of Livia, is that, you know, you have Claudius saying evil woman in all of his writings and these reflections, but he is the one to make sure that she is deified. And it's, you know, kind of the same thoughts I have as Hera in classical myth. It's like, you have all these terrible stories about Hera and how she's just a nitpicky wife for the most part, and yet she's worshipped. Where do we understand the actual relationship that existed between these individuals? And so I thought that was really interesting that you have Claudius saying all these things but not really seeming to like his grandmother, and yet he does make that active choice to deify her in the end.
Also funny that, like, we've had, I feel like, Claudius has very little screen time in comparison to some of the other like big characters that we have in this first half. And so I'm excited, one, to just get more Claudius, because now he's sort of an adult. He's a little bit more involved in politics, although maybe still trying not to be. He kind of, he's st- still there. He's still alive. But I'm also really excited for more Caligula.
Caligula is going to go full Caligula.
I can't wait.
What's interesting to me about when Claudius actually does become emperor is how he, like, even when he is emperor, he, like, can't fight against the tide. Like, even the emperor can't break the system, and how he's kind of stuck. And he, you know, because he mentions at some point in the show, he's like, I would restore the Republic if I could. And then when he's actually the emperor, he's sort of caught up in it, and he has this interesting kind of like crisis of being like, what's the point of being a good emperor? And, you know, I can be a good emperor and do a few things and build my harbor and build an aqueduct or something like that, but then like some Nero is going to come along after me, and he gets kind of nihilistic about it, but I won't give away any more than that. Is there anything we should say about the first half that haven't talked about yet that we should talk about?
I think the one thing I'm going to say is I want to flag up for this period. This is quite daring in that it has nudity, mainly women's topless nudity, some chap topless nudity, but mainly women. And I want to flag that up particularly in the way they decide to open the opening scene
of the first episode,
which begins with a banquet. Which is going to where Agrippa and Marcellus are going to kick off in a minute. But it begins with a dance of black people who appear to come from some kind of interesting native African tribe. It's never qualified, but they're dressed in sort of very stereotypical accoutrements without very many clothes on, dancing. And Augustus waves them off, going, oh, they were very good, very, very good. Make sure they get some decent food from the kitchen. And that setting of the start of the film that you've got, that kind of dynamic, that racist dynamic of white people watching black bodies, very exposed physically, black bodies being on stage, and you're just sitting there going, oh boy. Especially when you think about how many other people of color there are in the play, in the thing as a whole. There are a couple of enslaved people who are the masseurs in the scene between Julia and Antonia, who are treated as if they're complete idiots, when not all enslaved people are treated like they're incomplete idiots. So that kind of, again, is another set of racist dynamics. But other than that, that's kind of it. I mean, Rome is very white.
It is, again,
1970s, whatever. But, you know, let's
and
just
a lot
let's
of them seem like they've been at the Royal Shakespeare Company. Like, I don't know.
Well, I loved because like someone came in. Oh, when Herod as a young boy came in, it's like, oh, his Latin is so good. But this is all being spoken in English. And I'm like, that jives.
It feels very, in some ways, like of its time, that kind of exoticization or like fetishization of anywhere that's basically not white. And it reminds me a little bit, there's kind of a similar energy, and a funny thing happened on the way to the forum where they have very, you know, that basically non-white dancers, and it's sort of fetishized and exoticized in a very similar way. And then it also, even thinking ahead to like HBO Rome, where one of the first scenes is full nudity sex, and like the show kind of like trying to, you know, be like, strap in, folks, this is what you're in for. Like, it's going to be raunchy and scandalous and lurid. In all ways, like, these are the things that maybe age the quickest and age the poorest of the show.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Yeah, going back to what Liz was saying is that the only other slaves that are really called out are specifically Greek. So they have a culture, they're acknowledged as very, you know, poetic or something in reference to that. But like you said, it's like you just have this group of dancers who are just recognized by their race and not by like any kind of cultural or region that they may have come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And when you have other enslaved people in the film, they kind of just are standing around.
Yeah.
I mean, there's plenty of comments about how useless slaves are and how difficult it is to get good slaves now. And that kind of really actually quite uncomfortable dialogue now. I mean, yes, absolutely. Enslavers' households are going to be having those conversations, but sort of to us, however many years on, the dialogue feels we would write it differently.
I think also at some point they say like, oh, the people from Britain don't make very good slaves. I think that, and it's like, oh, okay, all right.
How convenient that all of the actors happen to be British.
Wow.
I mean, the whole, I forget if it's in episode one or two, where like they're playing basically like ancient Risk, and they're talking about invading Britain and how many legions you need to invade Britain and what's the point of invading Britain. It doesn't have anything of value there. It's like there's no money. The people make poor slaves. And then, you know, that feels very much like us like kind of sitting around being like, ha ha ha. And we've mentioned this before also of just, you know, in particularly like British media of Rome as sort of the British Empire. And like, it's like Britain almost kind of, what's the word, like reconciling with their own imperial history in, mm-hmm. in many ways, or justifying it, or, and, you know, because in this scene, like they are both colonizer and colonizee simultaneously. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have much to add other than that confusing jumble of thoughts.
Well, how about we end with our favorite scenes, because like this is a show that just has so many moments.
I have a hard time picking. I have a short list, I think.
That's fair. I will say that my favorite is the sit-down conversation between Livia and the poisoner woman. Mm-hmm. And they're just discussing like different poisons. And then
what a shame you never got a chance to practice. And Livia goes, yes, well, dear.
Just at that moment she looks up, she's like, oh no, and then Livy's like, I wouldn't poison you.
It's just wind. And then she like takes some of her food and puts it in her mouth. It's like, good god, I, you know, if so you good. If I was going to kill you, it wouldn't be this direct.
Yeah,
I really like the scene where they're all at like the dinner party and you just slowly realize that little baby Caligula is standing in the background. And it, and then he like coughs. Because they're all talking about poor Germanicus and like the dramatic way that he died. He thought he was being, you know, cursed or haunted. Creepy things that they found under the floorboards. And it's just Caligula standing in the background.
I could not live in the same house as that child.
He's just standing there. It's like, I played God of Death. It was so fun.
Yeah. He's like setting things on fire in his room. This kid's monster. Like,
oh. Yeah, that's like Claudius at some point say, like, when Caligula burned my house down.
Exactly. Yeah. I don't think I can pick. I think they are just, there's so many really good ones. And I think anything I would pick probably would involve Livia, actually. I think.
Yep.
Because, you know, it just would.
I think for me, it's the, although in a short, in coming in a close second is Augustus, you know, being, has anyone in Rome not slept with my daughter? But the main one is when Livia addresses the gladiators, because, oh, there's something I find so like, it's like, it's so macabre. It's so kind of awful, but like, I can't help but like, this is kind of great.
I will say there's one other line that like, it was in the first episode and it made me really be like, oh, this is going to be delightful. And it's the conversation between Agrippa and Augustus after Marcellus has died. And Agrippa's just like, oh, well, you're aware that I don't really care for my wife. And he's like, no, I wasn't. For the setup. And I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. No, I was not aware.
I mean, we didn't mention it all, but Ed, you kind of like I, you know, my heart goes out to him, but Claudius's marriage where he sits down to his wife and he looks over and he's like, oh, she's, yeah, like, yeah, this couldn't be the worst. And then she stands up and everybody laughs. And even Herod, even his friends are laughing at him at his own wedding. I'm like, as I watched that, I wrote down like emotional damage.
Yeah. Although I like that it shows the friendships that Claudius does have, because Claudius says like, she's taller than me, and Germanicus is like, dude, she's taller than me.
It's not just you.
Yeah, anyone standing next to her would have had that same problem, frankly. Yeah.
And the thing is, I've seen this show multiple times and I completely forgot about that dinner, and it got me again. I'm like, oh, his wife's not so bad. And then she stands up, I'm like, oh no, I see what they've done.
But it's a scene that's very cleverly managed with absolutely no words. Mm-hmm. Up until the point where Livia sort of has a hysterical moment at the end, and everything is done through just action and just the watching and then the slow immersion of laughter. And it's just, oh, so cringe, so cringe.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's a good place to wrap it up. Liz, we want to thank you again for coming on the show. It's been a delight to have you. Hopefully we haven't
ruined you. Thank you. That's been great fun.
Excellent. If listeners want to read, see, hear more from you, where can they do that?
So if you are at all monstrously interested, then Tracking Classical Monsters in Popular Culture is available from Bloomsbury. If you want to just see my randomness, I am on Twitter and Blue Sky as Liz Gloyne, all one word, and I also blog at Classically Inclined on WordPress, and that is updated sporadically when I have the bandwidth to do so.
Excellent. I feel that.
Yeah.
Listeners, thank you again. We hope you enjoyed the show. You can find us on moviesweadig.com. Follow us on Blue Sky at Dig Movies. And you can support us on Ko-fi under the same title. Our episodes are available on most major streaming services. Liz, thank you again. And we'll sign off. If you ever want to come back, doors always open.
Thanks ever so much.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.